Hello, and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass, and today I'm joined by...
Steven Slavinsky. I'm a senior economist at the Goldwater Institute in Phoenix, Arizona.
Thanks so much for coming on, Steven. I have you on today to talk about a couple of different things, but first I want to tackle this discussion that I've seen in the blogosphere recently. I think prompted by a New York Times piece about a month ago on whether economics counts as a science. Now, the central kind of dichotomy that I've seen is, well, requirements to be a science are that something has to have both a descriptive and predictive value. And by and large, I've seen kind of a consensus that economics does pretty well in the descriptive department, but pretty much fails across the board in the predictive department. You know, there are some things that can be predicted, that are predicted by economists, but by and large, those are not really repeatable on a consistent basis. So I'd like to get your view on that subject.
Yeah, sure. Now, I mean, I think I've heard it. Yeah, I've heard it described the way you've described it, that in order to be a real science, you need to have both descriptive and predictive abilities. I'm actually not so sure that's exactly right. I mean, I'm not so sure you should rule out certain aspects of any intellectual research endeavor just because the predictive capacity is not as strong as, say, the descriptive capacity. But I think the important part about economics is the ability to describe phenomenon as, or more specifically, describe phenomenon that seems to behave fairly well and figure out why it does what it does. But I do think that the criticism of economics as a science, or at least as a field, and more specifically the criticism of specific economists not to have successfully predicted the downturn or any phenomenon really over a certain period of time, that's actually a valuable criticism. Now, the question is, though, why might that have happened? And I think part of it is we might be looking at economics, with too narrow a definition. I think there's, and anyone who's probably been to a basic Econ 101 class probably gets the sense that there are actually various strains of economics. And in fact, there's various different focuses or foci, I guess, technically. You've got macroeconomics, and then you've got microeconomics. And I think macro is a little trickier to do no matter who you are, because they're dealing with very large, big phenomena and very broad aggregates, sometimes that don't respond and behave the way they used to, right? Microeconomics is different. Microeconomics takes a look at individual smaller groups even, but they also look at institutions and the rules of the game. And there's been a lot of work done at the microeconomic level to try to explain why certain things happen. Usually it's because there's a specific rule change or a specific set of assumptions or a specific set of realities and a contextual realities that change along the way. And so macro is hard, but I think a lot of it is because macro is, in a sense, a lot of guesswork, and a lot of it is ex post facto quarterbacking as well. Micro, I think, however, on the other hand, has been a lot more successful at deriving a set of axioms and principles for how people react relative to certain environments and relative to certain rules. And so I think those kinds of distinctions need to be made before anyone makes these broad claims about economics being useless for anything predictive.
Right. So let me dive into that a little bit more. How would you say that, I guess, the field of microeconomics has taken more steps to being maybe predictive, having a little better of a record, being able to figure out human behavior? And how does, I guess, psychology and behavioral economics play into that?
Sure. So there's a lot of things going on simultaneously in microeconomics. One of the new things, I say new, it's been going on for maybe about 20 or 30 years now, which in a lot of science fields, that's a relatively new thing to describe, and that's been the advent of experiments in economics. And sounds kind of odd. Really what they're doing is they're creating a sort of a laboratory in which you've got folks who are kind of coming in and playing basically playing games, sort of like video games almost, but they're not like Mario Brothers or something. It's like trading games. They'll come in and then they'll be given a list of rules, and then they will embark upon different types of transactions for certain periods of time. You might have heard about the concept of the prisoner's dilemma. This is sort of a very, very basic stylized version of what had become a lot more sophisticated in terms of the experiments. But the whole goal is to try to figure out how do people react in certain situations. And so this experimentalism, I guess, is sort of taken over a large portion of microeconomics. And I think that's actually a good thing. But the trick is to figure out what aspects are the most useful for, say, public policy analysis. And it seems the media is fixated on one of the two camps. And the two camps are what they call behavioral economics, and the other camp would be called experimental economics. Now, of course, that's not to say that the behavioral economists don't do experiments. They actually do. But the experimental economists come to different conclusions than the behavioral economists. And I think the best sort of a progenitor of these things are actually sort of the people who have made them the most famous. And those are the guys who jointly won the economics Nobel Prize in 2002. You got Daniel Kahneman on the one side, who's considered a behavioral, sort of one of the earlier behavioral economists. Then you have Vernon Smith, also, again, one of the early experimental economists. And what's remarkable about these guys is that they take completely different views and actually come to very different conclusions about microeconomics. Kahneman actually was a psychologist. That was his training. He had a degree in psychology. Vernon Smith had a degree, a PhD in economics from Harvard. And they come out about it in different ways. The behavioral school is made most famous by the fact that they have, proven that the rational actor model, but I guess obviously a very apropos discussion for this show, the idea of the rational actor, individuals, people don't really act rationally the way economists think they do. The experimentalists, though, have come at it from a different direction and found that oftentimes they do, if you're just giving them the right chance and the right rules. And just to step back for a second, and we can talk a little more about this specific assumption, but the idea of people being rational. You know, one of the things about economics that I think people miss, and it's a little more nuanced, is that the idea that everyone has to be rational for markets to work is actually kind of a misnomer. It's really not exactly what economists are saying. What economists are really saying, and this actually goes back to as far back as Adam Smith, the idea that markets act as if everyone is rational. It doesn't require everyone to be rational, but as long as the market itself functions within a certain boundary of what we might consider to be predictable behavior of sorts, that they produce outcomes that look as if everyone involved is rational. So I mean, that's an important point, and I think the behavioralists kind of miss that. Because what they typically focus on are the deviations from this very stark assumption of what they call homo economicus, the idea that everyone is always and everywhere rational. And that's really kind of, as I said, it's sort of a stereotype and a caricature of what economists really believe. The experimentalists, though, I think I'd take a little more nuanced view of this. So I think that's where that difference comes when you're thinking about microeconomics today.
Right, and I do want to probe on the rational actors thing that you brought up, obviously, because it's a kind of a play on words that's the subject of the show. It was my kind of understanding, and this is just, I guess, being in the media, that the behavioral economics has kind of taken root as one of the dominant schools of thought right now. And maybe that's just because a lot of the economics writers and bloggers that I read tend to be behavioralists. I was under the assumption that this kind of assumption that people aren't actually rational, even, on the aggregate level that you're talking about in order for markets to work. I've almost been convinced that maybe people aren't even predictably irrational in the way that Dan Ariely kind of wrote about a couple years ago. But I know you've written on the rediscovery of homo economicus and the possibility that actually, like you said, in the aggregate, people do act rationally, especially when we construct rules, as you said, that would govern markets in which people can and are kind of utility maximizing and our welfare maximizing and make the, you know, the same decisions that we would predict them to make if they were rational. So could you kind of try and, I guess, convince me that that model is still viable in light of all of the behavioral economics that we've seen developed recently?
Sure. Well, let me just give you a good example of how these experiments work and then what kinds of outcomes and analysis you can draw from it. The classic experiment that a lot of people point to as being kind of the nub of the behavioralist case against rationality is what they call it's part of what they call prospect theory, and I'll get to why they call it that in a second. But it's an experiment that gauges what they call the endowment effect, and these are both related. Basically, what they do is, and I'll tell you why the terms matter in a second. What they do is they'll start out and they get a room full of people, usually grad students, just because they're easy to get and they have low opportunity costs and you can pay them a little bit of money and,
right,
and get them to do these experiments. So they'll give them a mug. Well, actually, they'll randomly distribute two items, usually a mug and a pen. It's typical of how these experiments are run. So they'll randomly assign, give some people get pens, some people get mugs. And then they'll have a series of rules and say, okay, first of all, they'll describe the mug or the pen. They'll say, this is yours. You own this. It's a valuable commodity. Would you like to trade it for the other good? In as much as people would trade, the expectation is that if they are fearful of losses, so basically if they're averse to losing what they've endowed with, in this case, the mug or a pen, they're not going to trade because the devil they know is better than the devil they don't. They don't want to embark upon risk-taking activity, even if it is trading for something that they might not like as much. You know, if you really want a mug, but you're not quite sure, you really want a pen too, but you're a little worried about whether it works or whether it's going to be a really valuable trade in your mind, you might just stick with what you got because, well, I've got something. At least I can leave this room with a mug. And that's what the behavioralists have tended to find in these studies, is that people just don't trade because they're fearful of losing their endowment. The reason they call it prospect theories is basically because that embodies the idea that people are scared of the prospect of losing something. So that's effectively what it really means. Now, what's interesting about these experiments is, you know, they've been duplicated over and over again with the same rules and the same instructions. There are instructions they give, and they try to formalize those instructions between the experiments so they can duplicate them later down the line. And a number of different scholars have duplicated these results. Now, there's actually a group of experimental economists, many of whom are sort of students and actually colleagues of guys like Vernon Smith, who have been able to duplicate these experiments. But there's one catch. Once they duplicate the experiment, then they figure out, okay, does this conceivably look like an actual market environment? Think about what markets do. Markets are actually pretty good at teaching people. And if people are willing to pay attention, they're going to learn from their mistakes. There's also a great deal of information in markets that you don't often see. This is a very common strain in neoclassical economics and even Austrian economics, the idea of, you know, say, the price system as being a conveyor of information and all of these interacting elements conveying information, local information, as Hayek calls it, that one specific individual wouldn't have all of. But if they pick up on the signals and the cues, markets can work in that way. So the question is, do the experiments that the behavioralists are running, do they actually look anything like what markets look like in the real world? And are there specific rules they're putting in place that might skew the actual outcome? Because bear in mind, behavioralists are kind of looking mainly for deviations from rationality. They're not really looking for how to structure rules that might elicit rationality or elicit different or even better outcomes. So what the experimentalists have done is they've taken this the pen and the coffee mug experiment, duplicated the result, and then said, okay, what if we did something slightly different than what the behavioralists did and did something that might be a little more in line with the kinds of markets we see on a daily basis? One thing they noticed in the behavioralist studies is, and this is actually a study that was done, co-authored by Daniel Kahneman himself, whenever people wanted to trade, instead of doing it by, say, secret ballot or just going ahead and enacting the trade, people would raise their hand. You want to trade? Yes, you'll raise your hand. Now, there's a peer pressure element here, right? If you're all in the same room and you start seeing people raise hands, this might change your perspective about the relative values of the mug versus the pen. In addition to that, there was an ability for rather in these behavioralist studies, the students that were in this experiment, they weren't able to inspect the other items. So if you had a coffee mug and you had a pen, you didn't quite know if the pen was actually going to work or not. You might stick with your coffee mug because at least you know the coffee mug is going to work. And so the experimentalist said, okay, so what if we allowed people to enact the tray without signaling by raising their hand, plus they could actually go ahead and look at the other item and decide, you know, based on some pretty important information, whether they wanted to trade. And wouldn't you know it, trading actually increased. And the market outcome looked a lot more like a neoclassical equilibrium. There's a lot of trading going on, and people traded for what they found the most valuable. And so the question is, is experimental economics, I think, is best at looking at specific types of rules and testing those rules and seeing if it generates market outcomes. Also, not to get too far afield here, and I'll admit I'm not an expert in some of the stock market games they've done. They've created little stock markets in the laboratory with computers, and they've had students sitting around trading things. And they've been able to duplicate bubbles. Didn't mean that the rules were flawed. It just means that they found bubbles. But a lot of it was remedied by people figuring out the mistakes they made in the prior period. One thing about these behavioral studies is they were just one period games for the most part. Students weren't able to play them over and over again. At least the different students, they would do the experiments, they would do them at different times, and the same students weren't doing them more than once. The experimentalists decide they typically will do their studies more than once with the same group of students and learn from their experience. So again, they found that more rational outcomes existed as a result of these multiple period abilities to learn over time. And so I think that's an important part because, everyone's a repeat actor. Everyone's it's a repeated game, as they say, in the marketplace. And that's an important aspect. That's how markets really function. So if we're really interested in looking for rules that help markets become more rational and function better, you'd want to, in a sense, give the market the best chance to solve the problem. And so creating rules in an environment in the laboratory that looks most like a real market is really the best way to test those things.
Interesting. So, okay. So you're saying the experimentalist school is saying that what is kind of prime in some of these studies is the structure of the rules in which, people do act rationally rather than kind of behavioralists, I guess you're arguing, are trying to look for outcomes that we wouldn't predict, that seem to go against our traditional concept of rationality, which might not exist in the real world.
Yeah, I think that's generally right. And in fact, think about what, again, to come from an economist perspective, everyone has incentives and everyone's trying to maximize something. And so the incentive that behavioralists have been trying to maximize the amount of times they can find deviations from rationality. Now, that doesn't mean that's a bad prospect or a bad study unto itself, but I think it needs to be bounded by what the real value of those results are. If it turns out that you can then create an environment in which you tend to see deviations from rationality, that's useful, but it's mainly useful, I would say, for figuring out how to make sure you're designing the experiments later on to actually test things to bring the actors within the experiment closer to rationality. Usually what behavioralists do is that they find the deviation and then they stop. So, okay, there's our published result. And so we've already got the trading doesn't happen. There's clearly an endowment effect issue here. There's your journal article. And the experimentalists go one further and say, okay, well, what if we change something? Does that change the results? And usually it does, which is true of most experimental sciences, which is why I think it's important to make sure that people think of economics as a science in that, especially with experimentalists nowadays. And you can actually make a claim that economics is actually more of a science than it was before, because before a lot of it was very theoretical, which of course is still science. But now we've got a few decades worth of experiments down these paths, I think, that are being very useful at test betting, I guess you could call it, market rules and things like that.
All right, that might. I would probably have to reconsider my position on both behavioralism, I suppose, and economics as science, because I tend to believe a lot of what the behaviorists have to say, and I tend to believe that economics is not a science due to, I suppose we might be living in a unique era the post 2008 world in which a lot of economics seem to have gotten a lot of things wrong. But it does seem like, you know, maybe you've got a better case as far as experimental economics goes, of kind of the scientific method and possibly even steps towards prediction.
Yeah, and let me also make a suggestion. Maybe this is a more provocative point even. I kind of wonder if the idea of economics being bad at prediction is actually a feature and not a bug. And I say that because so much of, I think, modern macro is too almost too heavily quantitative and sometimes even divorced from reality. And I think in some ways, hard sciences obviously work well because of the fact that the interactions between the chemicals or the elements are fairly predictable, and they rarely change, if ever, as far as I know. However, the relations between economic aggregates actually change quite often, or at least not often. A long enough time frame, you'll see them change over time sometimes. Like, for instance, you know, the monetarists of the 60s and 70s, or 50s and 60s anyways, you know, I mean, the money supply responded differently then than it might today, for instance. So not to go too far down that path, but I do think that to the extent that economics is good in a descriptive way, figuring out, okay, why do those aggregates not interact? And then figuring out ways, maybe even with experiments, to figure out, why those digressions occur, can then give us more insight into how best to describe the world we see. And so the prediction part may not really even be the most important aspect of it all.
Okay. I'd like to move topics now. We talked earlier before this conversation, about your belief that, and this is kind of more in my wheelhouse as someone who lives in Washington, D.C. and kind of reports on Capitol Hill, on the idea that, you know, we're seeing a lot of gridlock nowadays. We're seeing obstruction. We're seeing largely as a result of divided government. And your belief that that's a good thing, which, you know, runs a little bit contrary to conventional wisdom in D.C. and in a lot of mainstream media outlets, but possibly not among a lot of, you know, ordinary median American voters.
Right. Yeah, and this is actually something that goes back a couple of decades. There's this, I'll kind of bring it to the subdiscipline of economics and then bring it back to the real world in a second. There's a subdiscipline within economics called public choice economics. It's a really terrible name for it because it doesn't really give you an indication of what it's all about. But it's basically taking the framework of economic analysis, which it hinges upon incentives and somewhat with irrational acting, but mostly with the incentives, and discovers that if you've got specific types of, say, congressional budget making processes or specific types of legislative processes, that, you know, you'll get certain outcomes if the rules are written a certain way. And so one thing that I've noticed, and this is actually something that's been held up empirically since World War II, when you have periods of what they call gridlock or divided government, you tend to see government shrink as a percent of GDP. Doesn't always mean that spending goes down in absolute dollar terms, even if you just for inflation, even if it just levels off. As long as spending rates of growth, you know, are close to zero, and that allows the GDP to catch up, and so you have government as a smaller share of GDP over enough time period, and that's usually a result, or often anyway, a result of divided government. Now, it's interesting to note because united government is actually sort of an anomaly in the post-World War II era. In fact, if you look at the periods when you've had, and by united government, basically what I mean is at least one House of Congress, or possibly both, is controlled by the same party as the president, right? At both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue being controlled by the same party for all intents and purposes. And you've really only seen that about three times since World War II, or at least since the 50s. And that would be during the period of Lyndon Johnson's, most of his presidency, during all of Jimmy Carter's presidency, and then during George W. Bush's presidency. Well, it's kind of interesting because if you look at the actual budget aggregates, the amount of money the federal government spends related to GDP, you saw massive spikes in spending during those periods. You didn't see those kinds of things when you had the generally known as, divided government. And what's unique is because, you know, you've got Johnson and Carter, certainly no small government aficionados. And then you got George W. Bush, who on paper at least was supposed to be a small government conservative and ended up not being. So the question becomes, if you had Republicans, many of whom were in the House and the Senate, who were kind of small government Republicans, many of them had come in with the Republican Revolution in 94 or been elected since in those 6 years since, or after that, rather, who, you know, they cut their teeth politically on the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan, and they might have wanted to cut government spending, and they just weren't able to. And I think that's because, I don't know, this is just me now saying this, I think Republicans work really better, really good when, you know, the other guy is controlling the White House or the other guy is controlling government. Because when your guy is in charge of Leviathan, you know, you're not going to take a swing at big government because you're going to hit your own teammate. And that's something that happens in with both parties when you have united government. So I think gridlock, for the most part, can not only degrade the rate of government spending, I also think there's the potential that the gridlock actually creates the only context and the only environment in which we might actually see some kind of policy action toward reform. I mean, we had the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, pretty much a product of gridlock and divided government. Other things like the 1986 Tax Reform Act. Now, granted, there was a lot of pressure from the White House with Ronald Reagan for that, but that was a bipartisan phenomenon that was occurring in a gridlock-type situation. So I think, you know, maybe thinking ahead to the types of reforms that we want to see, and also, I mean, think about Obamacare. That was actually a product of united government for that two-year period. So, again, I think we're starting to see a pretty clear pattern here. And so I'm actually kind of an optimist about the future of liberty in the United States because gridlock tends to be the norm, not the exception.
So here's where that seems to go wrong, I think. I would say there's two ways of looking at public policy making, and you're making one of the arguments. One is that you want good outcomes no matter what the process is, right? And that means, in your description right there, you know, slower government spending as a percentage of GDP, relatively shrinking Leviathan state, and that is, you're making the argument that that largely can come about, and maybe the best environment in which that can come about is with a divided government, possibly with Republicans as the minority, because they might work better as a minority party than a majority party. Mm-hmm. The other way that I see it, and this agrees with you in part and disagrees in part, is the best policy is the one that people vote for, right? The democratically just outcome. And the argument's been made that, in at least in our current environment, gridlock is what the American people voted for, right? We had 2 years of President Obama with a Democratic Congress and a short period where he had a supermajority in the Senate, basically meaning he could get past anything that he wanted to get past. Because like you said, when your party controls the executive, you don't want to take a swing at the executive. And in the 2010 elections, the American people voted in a bunch of Republicans. Basically because they either, you know, if you're a Democrat, they said, all right, we got what we wanted, now let's slow it down. Or if you're a Republican, they said, we want to get rid of everything that just happened. Now, I'm not sure, so I generally agree that a slower, more slowly growing federal spending state is a good outcome as well. And I actually think that gridlock in this case were getting that. I don't remember when. I think during the 2012 re-election campaign, President Obama said that he wanted to see the federal deficit shrink. He said that. Whether he believes that or actually wants it is up for debate. But he said he wanted to see it shrink. He wanted to see tax hikes to spending cuts package of approximately 3-1. And since 2011, we have approximately seen exactly what Obama said he wanted. We got, relative to extended baseline law, we got tax hikes at the beginning of 2012. In the 2011 debt ceiling standoff, we got the Budget Control Act, which total, including sequestration, which was put into effect then, cut 10-year government spending by, I think, $2 trillion. Maybe a little more than that. Along with the lapse tax hikes, we got some fairly significant medium-term deficit reduction. Now, that doesn't really address the long-term entitlement state, but it kind of got us at a relatively manageable deficit of about 3% of GDP for the next 10 years, which, you know, compared with what we were looking at a couple of years ago, isn't actually that bad. So I think that you can look at our gridlock today through both of those lenses, and maybe through both of those lenses we're seeing good outcomes. We're seeing a relative shrink of the deficit in the medium term, and we're seeing gridlock and obstruction producing good policy.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that analysis is correct. And in fact, I kind of take a cyclical view of the politics of this, is because periods of united government do tend to actually precipitate periods of gridlock later on. And the standard political science theory that is when you get a majority, you kind of overreach on a number of different things. I mean, you can make the claim that a lot of what went on during the George W. Bush years was overreach with either compassionate conservatism or foreign policy overreach or what have you. But precipitating a swing back toward the other party. And I think there's this general understanding. I think people do like gridlock and tend to vote for it. And I think if you just look at the polling results for congressional approval ratings, this seems to be pretty consistent. Everyone will say, okay, well, we don't like Congress, and Congress gets low approval ratings. And if you probe a little further, it's usually, well, everyone else's congressman is a crook, but my guy, he's pretty good. So if that were really the case, people were all worried necessarily about gridlock or the lack thereof, I guess, more specifically, they might vote differently. I guess what I'm trying to tease out, or I guess piece work my way through, is how these political cycles work relative to public opinion. But I do think there tends to be these swings, and you see a little bit of you see long term periods of divided government, I think, punctuated by small little failed experiments with the united government.
Yeah, I think that's about right. The my congressman's okay effect is really interesting, actually, because Congress, perpetually in my life when I've been politically active, has had awful approval ratings, always below 20%, sometimes below 10. I think they're at around 10 right now. And in that environment, even when Congress's approval rating is below 10%, you see two-term incumbent congressmen being elected with 98% success rate. It's really astounding when you think about kind of the amount of hatred that Americans have for Congress, and yet the rate at which they reelect their own congressmen.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And I don't quite know exactly how to explain it, other than the fact, there could be a number of different things, right? I think could be just the fact that people don't really vote with any specific coherent philosophy in mind. They just happen to vote straight ticket for some reason, or they vote a segmented ticket. I'm sure I think numerically it's probably likely that, these are swings. Congressional elections do occur at different times than presidential elections. There's one, every 2 years, and Senate elections are all staggered. So you can get a situation in which people who voted for, in this case, Barack Obama for president, might have voted for a Republican later on. And it may not necessarily be because they desire gridlock inherently or even directly. They may have a general sense that it's a good idea, but they may want to enforce that gridlock more often than not, sometimes or different times and relative to other times. And it could also just be that, they see their vote as being an expression of some kind of overarching will or just what they think is right. And so thinking about voter motivation is probably important in all of this, but that's the tricky part. We don't really know what motivates voters, I guess. As an empirical matter, we just don't.
Right.
Because exit polls may tell you, but only tell you what the voters said they felt about a candidate or why they voted the way they did may not actually be the real reason. I think there's also something, there's something called expressive voting, as I said. It's where they vote to express a certain type of attribute or an attitude that they hold. I think it's fashionable to vote for one thing over another. By the same token, there could also be expressive poll question answering, right? Somebody just be, oh, I'm going to answer this question and say, oh, I voted for such and such for reason X because, well, that's what I'm expected to say. That's what I think people want to hear from me.
Right.
So there's a lot of that in there too, and maybe that contributes to some of these cycles along the way.
Right. All right. I think that that should just about wrap us up for today. Thanks a lot for joining me again, Stephen.
Thanks for having me on.
And hopefully we'll see you. Well, we haven't met, but hopefully, you know, maybe sometime you'll get out to DC or I'll get out to Phoenix.
Absolutely. Hopefully. Take care.
Have a good one.